Welcome to Found at TU, a monthly podcast where we talk with University of Tulsa faculty about their research. I'm Jolie Jensen, Hazel Rogers Professor of Media Studies at the University of Tulsa, and today we're here with Jen Ragsdale, Associate Professor of Psychology. Welcome to Found at TU, Jen.
Hi, glad to be here.
Can you tell us who you are and what you study?
So I study employee stress, the different experiences people have at work that are difficult and challenging for them, what they bring home with them, and try to come up with strategies and things to help them improve their well-being and productivity.
That sounds like something everyone can relate to. Mm-hmm. So let's unpack that a little bit. Let's start with the idea of workplace stress. What kinds of things are stressful in the workplace for people?
I think probably one of the most common things across a variety of jobs people might have is the stress of dealing with other people. So it can come in the form of rudeness or incivility. So it could be an eye roll from a colleague, or it could be something a little bit more intentional where somebody's trying to undermine you. They're not providing information that's going to be pertinent for somebody to do their job. Or it could be increasingly more aggressive that it spills into violence in the workplace.
Wow. So other people are a stressor.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that stress people during at work?
Yeah, so the ways in which people do work, so the demanding nature of the tasks, so some place physical stresses on a person mm-hmm. versus some are going to be more cognitively challenging or demanding. And then you can add things like time pressure onto that. So having to do things quickly, having deadlines that you're coming up against, the pace at which work is done can be particularly stressful for people.
Okay, and obviously workplaces can offer combinations of these
yes.
at the same time. So I gather part of what you study then is how to recover from the stress of the workplace. So let's talk a little bit about what recovery means.
Yeah, so recovery from work stress is, it's not recovery in the sense of you're recovering from an illness or some sort of disease or something like that. It's more trying to undo and unwind from stress. So when we encounter stress, whether it's a lion in the savannah or it's, you know, that frustrating coworker who is clearing their throat and coughing all day and distracting you, a physiological response gets activated. So that fight or flight response gets activated, and that's not inherently bad. So what's good about that is it prepares us for survival, it activates us, but it becomes a problem when it stays activated and we don't shut it down. And so the recovery part is that shutting things back down, getting things back to baseline so that we can continue to be healthy and functional over time. And so we're healthy and functional when we have that adaptive response. We get activated when we're supposed to. We come down when we're supposed to. The problem is when things stay activated over hours, days, weeks, and months that we start getting into a territory where our physiological systems start to break down. You see increased risk for cardiovascular disease, burnout, things of that nature. And so recovery from stress is so important because it can prevent those things from happening.
Okay, so let's go back to recovery options, because a lot of us talk about work-life balance as if somehow life weren't stressful too.
Right.
So part of what I'd love to hear from you is what recovery options do we have?
Right. So when you're trying to decide on what's the best option for somebody to recover, really it's a variety of different things. And kind of one of the go-to recommendations is to do something different from work. Mm. So doing something different from the thing that's stressing you out, placing different demands on you. So if you have a highly cognitively challenging job, spending time doing something that's physically activating. It's also beneficial to do physical things when you have a very sedentary job. So when you're sitting at a computer all day, hunched over, even at a standing desk, you know, getting active and moving and using your body the way it was meant to be used can be very helpful. If you have a job that's very high in terms of emotional labor, so people in retail, for example, or people in call centers, you might need at least a little bit of kind of solo time to decompress. But at the same time, social support is going to be beneficial. So spending time with friends where you're not having to exert a lot of effort trying to regulate and control your reactions to people so you're not, you know, kind of putting on that fake smile with your friends.
Which is the emotional labor you're talking about.
Yeah.
So the idea that I'm hearing from you then is there's a kind of compensation or opposite or rebalancing so that for listeners looking at the kinds of stressors they know are in their job and then thinking about what would be its opposite almost. Is that fair?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think, you know, that's one way of thinking about it, doing something that's opposite from what you would do at work. The other way of thinking about it is doing things that are going to change that physiological response.
Oh.
So when you are highly stressed and you've got that activation going on, doing something to help you downregulate or unwind. So, you know, taking time to meditate, go to a slow yoga class, going for a walk, something that can kind of help slow things back down, and then do something different after you've had time to unwind that's going to help kind of recharge and re-energize you.
Mm.
So maybe it's, you know, cooking or doing a puzzle, something that's exciting and rejuvenating.
So I'm hearing there's sort of two phases to this. There's the down-regulation or the, and then rather than going, oh, I'm recharged, let me go right back into what's already stressing me out, which I think a lot of people do, right?
So. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so is this something that you're researching actively now? Can you talk about what your particular findings are? Because we've been talking kind of in general terms.
Yeah. So what I've been focusing on recently is what people do during their weekends in particular.
Oh.
So, you know, you had mentioned life is stressful too, right? And a lot of the research on recovery has looked at evenings, what people do after work. And there's not really a lot of time to do very much. And you're dealing with, you know, making dinner or shuffling kids around or, you know, paying bills or whatever other life things you're doing in that particular evening. The weekend gives you a little bit more time to do a variety of different things. And so that life stuff will still come up. And we do look at those things in my research. So what kinds of work-like demands people are experiencing.
Oh.
So household chores, taking care of kids, paying bills, doing that life administrative stuff, as well as continuing to do work. And we found some relatively interesting things. So it seems like, you know, there's the benefit of physical activity in particular, kind of across the board, but doing things like non-strenuous activities, watching a movie, just kind of lounging around, reading, that tends to facilitate those feelings of relaxation.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, it seems like doing work, although you end up staying connected to work, can have you returning after the weekend feeling a bit more optimistic and engaged if you've caught up on things that you were maybe behind on.
Ah.
So a little bit counterintuitive,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, and so certainly doesn't suggest that we should always be doing work to catch up to stay engaged. But for some people in some situations, there may be a benefit there from time to time.
So you're saying perhaps on a Sunday, checking your email, kind of clearing it out, getting ready for the day, but not necessarily fully engaging, but kind of clearing the decks for a reentry.
Yeah, and it's been interesting. I've gotten a few media inquiries asking about this phenomenon. I think they've termed it the Sunday scaries.
Huh.
Or Sunday blues or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that kind of psychological experience you have when, well, a sense of dread for some people that you know the impending doom of work on Monday. And so what can people do to kind of deal with that and prevent that? And something just as simple as checking in with email, making a quick to-do list so you know, here's what's coming. I don't have to worry about it. I'll get to it on Monday when it's there, can be potentially very helpful.
So it sounds like you're acknowledging the tasks, at least, preparing for the stress, but not feeling it at that moment. So
exactly.
It's like delaying that.
Yeah.
Well, what other research interests do you have that are connected with this?
So one of the things that I've shifted into is looking at the role of technology that it has really helped kind of bridge the what happens at work and what happens off work interfaces. So with the advent of course, early on computers, laptops, emails, but now in particular with smartphones, we are connected to work constantly.
Yes. Potentially, right. Anyway.
Yes, but, yeah. Yes. Some people are very fortunate enough to have jobs that they can leave at work and aren't getting text messages, emails, and so forth. But a lot of people are. And there's some benefit to it. So having the flexibility to, you know, leave work early, to go to a kid's game, to go to a doctor's appointment, whatever it might be, so you can fit that important life thing into your schedule, you can also stay connected and catch up on what you may have missed by attending that event. So it's been very helpful for people, but at the same time, the potential for increasing work hours by staying connected through email is potentially problematic. It keeps that stress response I was talking about activated. Mm-hmm. So you're continuing to think about work. You might actually be doing work in terms of responding to emails, reading reports, offering commentary. And then you might even be facing that interpersonal stress again as well. So if you get that email from that coworker that you don't like, that's also going to activate that stress response for you. And it may do it if you are a habitual email checker like I am. It may do it at really inopportune times, like 10 o'clock on a Sunday evening when you really need to be getting ready for bed and getting good rest.
Mm-hmm. The way I experience it is kind of I have a work head and I have a mom head or a family head, that kind of thing. And so mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about the ways in which this technology does kind of force us to have like multiple attention, or is it multitasking? What is it?
Yeah, so people like to talk about having this great ability to multitask because of technology. I can do all these things at once because of my smartphone, the smart home system I have, whatever it is. But unfortunately, the thing about multitasking is that it's a myth. So really what happens with our attention, we physically cannot focus our attention on multiple things at once. So what we're actually doing is shifting our attention very quickly from one task to the other, and that comes at a cost because it takes some time to focus and attend to that particular task that we're interested mm-hmm. in. So that's why things like, you know, talking on your cell phone and texting on your cell phone while driving are so problematic. We think we're good at driving. It's a relatively automatic thing, so we can just check that text message really quick. But you're taking your attention away from the road and very much your eyes and things like that. And so you're going to miss, you know, certain dangerous situations. You're going to have a slower reaction time.
And there's scientific evidence
yes.
for this. This is incontrovertible.
Exactly.
Right? We do not multitask.
Exactly.
And yet, don't you think most people believe they are and can?
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And it's facilitated by having multiple tabs in our browsers and integrating and syncing everything between our work computers and our phones and, you know, Alexa and all of that stuff mm-hmm. gives us this illusion that we're able to keep track of all of these things at once. But really, I think it comes at a cost to not only our productivity, but also our well-being, because mm-hmm. it's draining to try to switch our attention across all of these things on a regular basis.
Draining and fragmenting, and mm-hmm. I would think, is there physiological evidence for a kind of fight or flight? I notice that my breath gets shallow as mm-hmm. I'm juggling all these tabs, trying to get an email out that includes content from over here, but maybe about that. Does that sound, am I, say, making too much of the fact that that itself feels yeah. stressful, at least to me?
No, I think that is absolutely very likely. So when you're working across all of these devices, and especially with different sources of information, there's that likelihood of experiencing information overload. So it's too many stimuli happening at once. And that can be very stressful and, again, activate that same kind of stress reaction.
And then going back to what we were talking about before then, one of the counteractants then to information overload would be something like meditation or one-pointedness or a hobby that involves knitting mm-hmm. or something like that.
Yeah.
Not to go to something similar but on a fun topic or something. Does
right.
that make sense? So instead of work-related multi-tabs, you're doing yeah. Pinterest multi-tabs or something.
Yeah.
That wouldn't necessarily do the restorative.
Yeah, so I think, especially when we're talking about something like technology, there is a lot out there in the media right now talking about how important it is to disconnect,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you're doing this stuff at work that you need time away from, you know, your screens because you're overstimulated and all of these things, and I mean, there is evidence coming out about the effect of blue light and interfering with our sleep, and even using things like Facebook and being involved with social media can be potentially detrimental to our well-being depending on how you engage with it. So what happens a lot of the time with things like Instagram and Facebook is people are very often posting the good things that happen, the beautiful life experiences. So when you're talking about Instagram and you're seeing pictures of friends who are at this beautiful lodge or hiking or striking this incredibly complicated yoga pose on a mountainside, you don't see, you know, the 100 other shots that were taken to get that one perfect shot, and you don't see all the photo editing that was done. And so we end up doing these upward comparisons where we compare ourselves to people that have more than we do or have a better life than we do, and that can impact our self-esteem very negatively.
Sure. And that sounds somewhat different than the kind of physiological reactions you're talking about. That seems to me to be more quote-unquote psychological. When you do your measurements, tell us how you and others who are studying similar areas figure this out, the detrimental effects.
Talking about technology and things, what's really interesting is how increasingly more accessible it is to get physical measurements or biometric measures on people. So basic things, even like heart rate, you can wear a Fitbit.
I bet these wearables have changed your field completely.
Oh, absolutely.
They? Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly there's a lot of really high-end stuff out there that people are using. But a study that we've been doing in my lab, we've been using a Fitbit to keep track of our participants' heart rate. And we compared it against, you know, the finger heart rate monitor that you might wear at the doctor's office or the chest strap that athletes might wear. And it was equally reliable. And so we ended up using that for our study. And basically, we've been keeping track of the heart rate while people are doing a stressful task.
Hmm.
So they're getting faced with impossible anagrams. So I think there are maybe only two anagrams they can actually solve. And then at the end, they get false feedback that says they performed very poorly. They're in the bottom 10% compared to everyone else who have done this, because we're trying to impact their sense of self.
Yeah.
And we also do very attention-draining tasks where we have people click the letter E in passages from a stats textbook, which is incredibly boring. Right? And so doing that for, I think, about 15 or 20 minutes or so, which is just horrible. My students who've run these sessions have commented on when people are going through it, they're just like, oh. But so we've been able to track people's heart rate, and it does get a little elevated during these tasks. And then when we're done, we send them to randomly assign them to either a relaxation task where they do progressive muscle relaxation. So they lie on the floor, we turn down the lights, and they have a recording that guides them through a relaxation exercise. Or we put them on an exercise bike, so they're doing something active.
Huh.
So,
but not cognitively stressful.
Exactly.
And they don't feel ashamed or inadequate.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so, you know, we've been able to use the Fitbits to monitor their heart rate to make sure they're actually putting forth the effort behind the exercise bike and that they're actually receiving the relaxation benefit from the progressive muscle relaxation. And so for us, we've been able to use it as kind of a manipulation check in some ways to make sure the conditions they're in are doing the things they're supposed to be doing. But then psychologically, what we found is that people rated their level of relaxation after both activities the same.
No kidding.
Yeah. So regardless of doing something physically active or physically relaxing, the groups didn't differ in their reports of relaxation.
That's their self-report.
That's their self-report.
Right? So is there a way to measure relaxation in some, I mean,
well,
or
so
well-being, or do you see what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing that I think is tricky sometimes about looking for a physical measure of well-being is that what we currently have, it's very often difficult to tell what is that thing actually measuring. So one example is, you know, again, with a heart rate monitor, for example, if we had gotten somebody who maybe had just had a couple of cups of coffee, you know, right before doing, like, the stress activities, it's hard to know if we're capturing the increased heart rate because of being under stress, or is it because of the caffeine intake?
Right.
And so that is some of the limitation that we have with a lot of these biometric measures and things. But that's where it becomes really important to have the corresponding self-report to see what else is going on at the times at which we're seeing, you know, increases in heart rate, increases in blood pressure, changes in hormones, things of that nature. Mm-hmm.
I notice when you're talking about this, you say we, so it's not just you doing this. Can you talk a little bit about the conditions that you use? You know, what's it like to do your research?
Yeah, so right now I am working with a handful of graduate students and undergraduate students in my lab. So in terms of, you know, working with the graduate students, it's usually they're facilitating data collection of some kind. They are helping generate ideas, cleaning data, things like that. But they're also getting ready to do big milestone projects, so things like working on their dissertation. Versus undergrads who are more dabbling in the research experience, and so they might help run some subjects. They might do kind of a senior project if that's something that, you know, we can work in, where they might put together a quick questionnaire, collect some data pretty quickly, something like that.
So in some ways, it sounds like lab work is also a teaching. It's another form of teaching.
Yes.
In that you're helping them learn at the undergraduate level what lies behind these findings that we read about. And then at the graduate student level, training them to become researchers themselves,
mm-hmm.
with the support and experience that you have to offer and all the struggles that research involves, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk about what you like best about doing this? And then obviously next question, what you like least?
Yeah. So, you know, it's actually a good time to ask me what I like most about this, because I have a student who will be graduating with her PhD. So I've been working with her for 5 years. And, you know, that's one thing that's particularly unique and special about working with graduate students is it's much more than a, you know, supervisor-subordinate relationship. There's the mentoring role that goes into it, and you see this person develop over this span of time and help prepare them for their career.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been really rewarding and exciting to work with a student and see her grow and become more confident. And she has also really kind of, you know, whipped my lab into shape in terms of just organizational things, keeping track of stuff. So it's going to be kind of tough when she leaves, just making sure I know where everything is and who's doing what with what and when.
But the reward is watching that growth over the five
yes.
years. And I take it she's off to a job or, doing what kinds of research?
So she's going to actually take on a consulting role. So one of the things about industrial organizational psychology that differs somewhat from other areas of psychology is that we are well-placed in both the academic sphere as well as within the workplace. So some students will go off and get jobs doing internal roles in an organization. They will be an organizational development person, work in HR, do data analytics, or they may work in an external consulting role. And I think the example people always like to give is from Office Space, the Bobs from Office Space that come in. But so it could be something, if it's an external role where they're in the background doing research, or it could be in front working with clients, doing sales, things like that. And it runs the gamut from developing selection systems for employees, so how do you hire the best people? It could have to do with things like leadership development, designing and implementing well-being programs. So, I mean, there's so many things that, you know, IO psychologists do mm-hmm. that I think people don't see or are not really aware of.
So unlike some fields, you can go into the work world
mm-hmm.
using these, and you can also go into academic life doing pure research, which
exactly.
is more of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what makes a job a good and a bad fit. And I would assume that a bad fit would increase stress, right?
Yes.
So can
yes.
you talk more about that?
Yeah. So one of the things that is, I think, a unique challenge when you're talking about any type of issue with employees, whether it's finding the right employee for the right position or dealing with a conflict issue or whatever it is, there's no one-size-fits-all approach because we all bring different things to the table. So what's going to be a good fit for one person may differ for another. But in general, when you're hiring, you want to find people who have, you know, basic minimum set of qualifications for doing a job. And in some ways, it might be a little bit easier hiring for those entry-level employees where there's a lot of opportunity for training and development within the organization. Where things get challenging and we see some trouble with misfit is when people get promoted into higher-level roles because they were so good at the job they did, but they're not necessarily prepared for doing that leadership role. And so that becomes very stressful for them because they're doing a very different thing in terms of managing people compared to the job that they were doing before.
And they're used to doing their job very well.
Exactly.
So it must feel very stressful to and pressured.
Yeah.
Well, what about from the employee point of view, finding a job that fit? In other words, I assume that a lot of people feel highly stressed at their job. And one of the questions they might ask themselves is, is this just a bad fit for me? Or are there little tricks I can be using? But for some people, no amount of meditation and, you know, alternative can really make, I would assume, make the job right for them. Is that?
Yeah. So there are going to be some things where, some situations where it's just, it's not the right place for that person to be. And it doesn't have to do with a gap in skills. It's very likely something to do with the climate of the organization. So it might be the people in the organization, the policies, the values, something like that, where if they were to do the same job in a different company, they might be fine.
And that's one of the first questions one should ask oneself. Is it the job or is it the context?
Yes.
And let's say it's not the context, it's actually the job. Then this is where IOPsych offers also ways of, you know, tests you can take or temperament and suggestions and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so, you know, one thing that IOPsychologists can do is, especially if you're seeing this problem across multiple employees, is come in and see, basically you'll do a needs assessment and see if there's a gap in the skills, the knowledge, the resources that employees have versus what they actually need to do the job. And then we can offer trainings and other such things to kind of bridge the gap, to get people up to speed, offer recommendations about new hiring practices, something like that to deal with that particular workforce issue.
We're coming to the end of our time. One thing we like to do is ask if you can recommend any books or articles or accessible things about any of the issues that you think are most interesting and that you're researching.
Sure. One thing that I've been listening to that's been helpful is another podcast. And Gretchen Rubin, who does some work on happiness, has a podcast about happiness that she does with her sister where she talks about, you know, different strategies and things to build habits to help people be happy and productive. So it runs, you know, from little things like tackling a list. I think they call it the power hour. It's like tackling a list of the things you don't want to do in that first hour and just running through them and getting done with it. And so all kinds of little things that are doable and accessible to people to help them, you know, manage their stress and make things easier on them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing that I have found to be particularly interesting. And then there is a book that has just come out. I forget the author's name, but it's called Dying for a Paycheck. And it's really emphasizing how this, again, culture of overwork, how we're working too much and how it's affecting people's health and functioning in very serious ways. Let's see, it's called Karoshi in Japan, where people have died at work because they work themselves to death. And so it's a real problem.
And there's physical death. There's also sort of soul death and psychological death, kind of going numb or, phoning it in. So, well, thanks so much for being here, Jen. It's really, it's been great talking with you. I'm Jolie Jensen, and this has been Found It to You, a monthly podcast produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the TU campus. We've been talking with Jen Ragsdale, Associate Professor of Psychology here at the University of Tulsa. And please join us next month for another chance to hear a University of Tulsa faculty member discuss in everyday language the nature and value of their academic research.